Okay, so I, first of all, I'm a bit dazed because of the 26-hour flight yesterday, and as you can tell, and also I decided 3 minutes before leaving that I was not going to talk about what I was going to talk about either. I had been planning to talk about these kinds of things, hydrodynamics and Yaev-Zeldovich simulations, which we've been working on and off for a while. Here, so a group, my student and Dominguez Barbosa, a lot of you know, and Peter Thomas have been working on these, and we had a paper out. I think it's actually, it could be its first anniversary today with some results of this kind of ilk. But endless people have talked about hydrodynamical SZ simulations over the last few days, so I thought you were probably fairly sick of that, and I talk about something else instead. So it's at best tangentially related to the entire topic of the program, because I was actually going to tell you a bit about X-ray clusters. So this only really relates to the microwave background in the sense that at some level X-ray clusters are going to be important as possible targets for looking at microwave background effects. So this is a typical X-ray cluster, Colma cluster, seen in X-rays by the ROSAT satellite. I've not given this talk as much thought as I should have done, probably, as you will see. But it's really supposed to just be a chatty talk about something that I will be doing in the future. But first, I'll set a bit of scene for why people are one reason why people are interested in galaxy clusters in the first place. And that's galaxy clusters to be used as cosmological probes. So there's lots of reasons why we should be interested in galaxy clusters in detail, questions of their structure, for example, their content, such as baryon content. But my talk is largely going to be concerned with using them as probes of the density perturbations in the universe. And to talk about different things you can do with clusters. And the reason why I'm telling you about it is because of a survey which will shortly be beginning using the XMM satellite to try and build up a large catalog of galaxy clusters. So several people in the room have worked on this kind of stuff from time to time. For example, the sorts of things you can hope to measure with galaxy clusters are the size of density perturbations in the present universe, usually the famous sigma 8, the scale dependence of that size, which is pretty tough to do, that's to say something like the spectral index of the power spectrum on scales around about 8 megaparsecs or so, which is at best very weakly determined by present data, and more importantly probably of the time evolution of these quantities, which is where the focus is largely going to be in the future, I think. More or less, I think this is done modulo, shrinking the error bars, and maybe the number will move a bit. But there's not going to be anything too exciting there. So the main thing is the future is the time evolution of the size of density perturbations. And the reason why people have tended to be interested in this is that it's a probe of the density parameter of the universe, omega naught. I should also mention in passing that it's also potentially a probe of the cosmological constant lambda, once we've got data of good enough quality. And the gist of it is that if you're in a low density universe, there's lots of high redshift clusters, and otherwise there aren't. And because it's such a specialist audience, you all know this. This is the kind of curve which shows you, for example, here, the number density of some very hot clusters as a function of redshift, as predicted by a Prescher approach. So different lines are critical density cosmology down here. And by redshift 1, there's basically no clusters at all above 7 keV, whereas in two low density cases, open and flat, flat one being the preferred one, there's a substantial number. So a difference of two orders of magnitude in the number density at redshift 1, provided you've normalized them to match the present day number here, which is known to perhaps a factor of 2 or so from current data. So this is the context. Basically, people have tried to measure this difference here. And to do that, you have to know the masses of the clusters, or, well, really we're using the temperature here, but the purpose of the temperature is to estimate the mass. And something that always comes in this business is whether or not the mass-temperature relationship has been determined very accurately or not. I'm not really going to say anything about that either. So what is the current status? Using surveys with high redshift clusters, on the whole, it's pretty disappointing, I would say. There are very few high redshift clusters known. And as you know, high redshift in the cluster business does mean redshift of 0.5 up to 1, something like that, nothing higher than that. largest numerical catalogues are ones built up from the ROSAT catalogues. There's a number of these, which all contain something like several hundred clusters each in total. Unfortunately, these are not that useful for probing things like the density parameter, because almost all of the clusters are at low redshift, almost certainly redshift's less than 0.3 or so. And also, in many, many cases, there are not adequate temperature estimates for these clusters. There are only luminosity estimates. And luminosity is not a very good guide to the mass at all. So people have tried to use the luminosity function rather than the temperature function to constrain cosmological parameters have not been very successful so far. So at high redshift, everyone basically is still using something which is coming up for 20 years old, the EMSS survey using the Einstein satellite. And the only significant development in this regard is that a lot of the clusters, there's 90 clusters in this sample, now do have improved temperature estimates using the ASCA satellite. But the ASCA satellite was not useful for actually trying to find new clusters at high redshift. It could only operate on this sample, and it's stuck with whatever horrendous selection effects the EMSS sample may have to deal with it. So, pretty much the state of the art, and many, many people have worked on this data and other similar data, and people in this room are working on it this very moment, I believe, at least in their heads. And I would say sigma 8 is very well understood. What? Sigma 8 is pretty well understood. Millions of people have done this. I only mentioned these ones because I'm one of the authors, but of course the history goes back a long, long way, and back into the late 1980s, in fact. I could probably write about 50 authors down after that, if there was space in the transparency. On omega naught, the situation is much more controversial. And there's been an order of something like 10 or 15 papers trying to determine omega naught from basically this sample or other related samples. And people have been deriving almost any answer between omega naught of about 0.2 and omega naught of about 1 or so. It depends where you are, pretty much. Well, it depends where you are in the world, because if you're in the east coast of the United States, your omega naught values always tend to be rather low. If you're in Europe, they tend to be particularly high. If you're in the rest of America or elsewhere, then they might be somewhere in the middle. I was also interested to find that there's an alphabetical bias. Some of you have seen me talk about this before. There's a very nice plot by Vincent Eek on these 15 papers. Unfortunately, Netta Bacall stole this transparency from me to conference because she liked it so much she took it and never gave it back. What you do is you actually plot the value of omega naught. So this is some sort of log plot from 0.2 up to 1. And instead of plotting anything sensible along the x-axis, you plot the initial of the first author of the paper. So you start with A here, and you work your way up to Z. And what you find is, as Vincent Eek first discovered, if you're someone like Netta Bacall, your results are down here. If you're me, then I will put Pedro Viana first, so he takes the responsibility, and we find answers up here. The French are usually Sadat et al. Over here, there's Eek et al. Down here. Then Reichardt et al. Live here. Henry lives here, and so on. And it's very, very well fit by a straight line. And in fact, this straight line is not horizontal at 95% plus confidence.
Why do you get such high values?
Because we do the analysis properly. I would contend. The key ingredient is that our error bars are very large, and we don't actually exclude their results. Is the main reason. So dispute, I mean, I'm kind of, you know, you can draw a horizontal line that goes through all of the error bars. I think there's broad consensus in most parts of the world that the best fit value is around about 0.5 or so.
But it's not that your error bar encompasses theirs, because you're just saying that their error bar is too small.
I'd say their error bar, right.
Your large error bar is not the central value.
Right, okay, I will come to that. I wasn't really going to talk about this, but I can say a few words about it. I'm just making a gag. The error bars are too small. Right. One of the problems with, first of all, there's the data you use. If people use the standard EMSS sample, it's intermediate redshift, which is a collection of 9 clusters between redshift 0.3, that's more than 9. It's now between 0.3 and 0.4 and a few more beyond that. They'll get an answer of about 0.5 or so. The way in which you can get a low answer is to use some of the very high redshift clusters, particularly this character here, the extremely hot one at 0.83.
Well, and if you, the key is just having a marker.
But the key is, or a low author. Let me see, I have a modest theory as to why this author effect exists as well, which is that if you get a low value, that's the accepted wisdom. And so you often on all the low author papers, it's the senior collaborator tends to be the first author. So, you know, Bacall, Henry, etc., etc., etc. And as you drift to the right, it becomes more and more predominant to be the student and the postdoc who's suddenly been promoted to the top of the author list, with the more senior people lurking in the second to fourth author kind of slot. But I would say it's just chance. And, you know, if you plot enough things, you get a 95% result once in every 20. Let's not forget that. There's another important effect, though, on the error bars. This is, when you're doing clusters, bear this in mind, because lots of people seem to get this wrong. If you read one of Netta Bacall's papers, for example, you may find a perfectly reasonable one sigma error bar of 0.1 on this. This will not mean that the two sigma limit is 0.4, because the error bars and all of this cluster stuff, when you're using the redshift evolution, the evolution is extremely sensitive to omega naught. Once you're down at low omegas, but becomes much less sensitive once omega's up above in the 0.4, 0.5 region. If you ever get error bars, the error bars are always enormously asymmetric to the top end, and the quoted error bars in the literature normally don't respect that. So, well, I'm just saying that instead of plotting the one sigma thing, if you plotted two sigma, you know, you'd find it was something like this. Hardly goes down at all at the bottom end, goes up a mile at the top end. So I would say the current data pretty much favors 0.5. The analysis I've been involved in does not rule out 1. It also, I don't think, rules out 0.3 either. And I'm not aware of any reason why it should be any lower than 0.3. With... Oh, yeah. Oh, sorry. You're very taken by this particular graph. It's probably a... So what I hope to have convinced you with that is only that the whole game is rather controversial, and the reason why it's controversial is, on the whole, the data are not very good.
So Blanchard
et al. Claim
that one of the big differences is the
local sample. Sadat et al, yeah. They push it up by modifying the local sample, that's right. And you guys might be about to find the same thing, I believe. Yeah, that's right.
Everybody's using the same systems. But the key will be XMM.
Yeah, so I want to talk about XMM and a survey, which is hopefully happening again as we speak in some form or other. So we're basically looking, and the problem is bad data. There are X-ray satellites which ought to give good data. How do you actually go about doing well using those satellites in the situation? So a gang of us, this lot here, got together to try and figure out what sort of results you might be able to get with XMM. I should highlight there are two things you need in a survey using one of these satellites. You need high sensitivity, although because you have to get to high enough redshift to see the place where the curves are very different. So you need high sensitivity, but you also need a large area because there are hardly any of these things at all. Now, XMM, Chandra especially, have very small fields of view. And it turns out that if you actually try to do a dedicated survey with XMM, getting the amount of time that you might be very lucky to get, your chances of seeing any cluster redshift greater than about half are very, very small indeed. Because it cannot survey really even as large an area as the EMSS sample. Although it has much higher sensitivity when it makes the observations. So Chandra can satisfy this easily, XMM also, in fact, fairly easily. This is the main problem with finding an effective survey strategy for X-ray satellites. And the way you get around that is well known. You have to do a serendipitous survey. I'm assuming everyone knows what one of those is. Does anyone want to be? Well, you take a pile of everyone else's data. Basically, you look in the data archive, which will be stored in Leicester at the XMM Survey Science Center, And you crawl through everyone's data who was looking at everything else, so looking at a star in the foreground or something. And you, the frame's pretty big, the thing they're looking at sitting in the middle of it, but all around the edges is basically freely selected distant space. And you look in that region to see whether or not you can find anything interesting. And this has been done with ROSAT in particular, several surveys of that kind looking there. And typically in ROSAT, about 40% of all the data that was ever used is of good quality for doing that kind of work. The thing which fails is if you're down in the galactic plane, for example, or people resurveying the same area over and over again because they're particularly interested in one kind of thing. Or if they're looking specifically at a cluster, you might be a bit worried because you might pick up other clusters at the same redshift, which are part of the same large-scale structure, et cetera, et cetera. But something like this will generate a large enough data set that you can actually try and get a decent-sized galaxy cluster survey out of it. The sort of area, sky area, being surveyed in XMM data ought to be somewhere around 100 square degrees per year. That might be a slight overestimate because it turns out in flight that it's going to have to be shut down for a part of each orbit because of the particle background. The mean sensitivity, based on pre-flight data, was 10 to the minus 14 ergs per square centimeter per second. It will potentially be a little larger than that because particle background, as you probably know, is a bit larger than was expected as well, though I don't think they've actually decided precisely the value. I don't know, and you guys all heard an XMM talk from the last couple of weeks, so you know better than I do what the situation is, I'm sure. So what we did in our preliminary work is basically a pile of theory with instrument modeling to try and figure out whether what sort of characteristics a serendipitous survey with XMM would carry out. So we've done what I would say were some extremely sophisticated simulations, which are in interminable detail in our paper, if you want to go and read it, working out the various aspects. So the easy bit, the bit everyone had done before, is to compute what you think's actually there, the number of clusters of a given temperature and redshift. But then there's lots of other things you have to do before you can figure out exactly how many clusters you might be going to see in real life. So for example, probably the biggest theoretical uncertainty is understanding how the luminosity in the X-rays relates to the temperature of the clusters. At the moment, there's not really any good theoretical understanding of how this relationship, how it exists at zero redshift, and also how it might evolve with redshift. So far, we've made the minimal assumption, which is almost certainly not very good, which is to take the observed luminosity-temperature relationship in the local universe, which is fairly accurately known, and to assume that that does not evolve out to high redshift. Hopefully within the next month or two, we'll have hydrodynamical simulations which are good enough to actually have a theoretical prediction of a luminosity-temperature relationship, which will evolve at the redshifts we're interested in. But at the end of the day, the data will say what the luminosity-temperature relationship is, so it can be bootstrapped into any analysis anyway. But if it does change significantly, if there's a lot of evolution, then the numbers I give you may change by some quite significant amount. The thing which was all the hard work, which Kath Romer did, was the detailed modeling of instrument sensitivity and background. So we're trying to do simulations which were as accurate as possible. So for example, you have to take into account there's different sensitivities as you go off-axis in XMM frames. There's particle backgrounds to be modeled. There's the actual spectral forms from the clusters. And we did a very large set of models. In fact, 144,000 different models were run for clusters of different redshifts to figure out how likely they were to be seen under different circumstances. So that was really a lot of work there. And this bit is just, in order to find out what you're going to see, you have to have some idea of what sort of observing times people are going to use. So we looked at the guaranteed time program, which was available then, to see how long the different pointings are. For such a survey as ours, it would actually be ideal if everyone did the minimum pointing, which is 5 kiloseconds, looked in lots of different areas, because sensitivity is not really the problem. You want more area, but people, unfortunately, they're not always very interested in clusters and tend to think it's quite good to point for 30 kiloseconds or 100 kiloseconds at one object. So that changes it all. Anyway, you put all of that in and you get two things out. One is the total number of clusters you expect to observe. And that's what I'll be showing you in the next transparency. The second thing though is perhaps more pertinent, and I'll show you some results on it, which is that the interesting clusters are the ones where you actually know the temperatures. Potentially here there's a lot of clusters, so you're particularly interested in the ones where you can measure the temperatures without taking any further X-ray data beyond the things you're already using. Typically, an X-ray cluster needs order of a hundred to a few hundred photons to be detected as an extended object, but needs of order of 1,000 photons in order to yield a sensible temperature estimate, which will be accurate at the 10 to 20% level. So this sample here, the clusters with temperatures, is a much smaller sample than the total number of clusters which will be available. I should also mention, and I'll be saying a little bit about this at the end, with the only new transparency I've got, is that when I say that you get the temperature, the thing you actually get from the data is normally just the apparent temperature divided by 1 plus the redshift of the cluster. In general, you do not get the redshift of the cluster from the X-ray data alone. There are exceptions if there are line features like the iron line visible, but in most of the clusters we're interested in, that's not expected to be the case. So you actually need some sort of further work in order to measure the redshifts of the clusters in order to separate this out and get the redshift and the temperature separately in order to do what you want to do. And that might be quite a substantial task, in fact, so I'm going to be ending by saying a few things about that particular point. These are the ballpark figures that we believe a survey is likely to take. I've just, on this slide, focused on the most the hottest clusters here. This is for a full 10 years of observations with XMM, so it's potentially a long-term project. I think I'll be bored after about 3 or so, so fortunately it looks like things will work quite well for 3. So the gist of it is, this is our favorite cosmology, the flat, low-density one. This is a critical density one. These are clusters above 4 kV. These are ones above 6 kV. Green is all of the clusters, and red is the ones with temperatures as well. So, and these are high redshift, and these are low red, and these are all the clusters. So, for example, if you look at clusters of temperature 4 kV or more, we expect to have order of perhaps as many as 1,000 of those clusters. And something like half of them will have data of good enough quality that you can measure the temperature. Remember, on the whole, those ones will be the ones which are nearest us. And by the time you get up to 6 kV, you expect an order of magnitude less there, but actually a better fraction of them with temperatures because they're hotter, so there are more photons.
Is there any effect, like, if the temperature is higher, it's easier to get the temperature?
Yeah, because the photon counts will typically be higher. Yeah, there's different effects, and we've done simulations with X-spec transfers. It's easier to measure accurate temperatures for low temperature clusters if you have a given number of photons. Mm-hmm. But when you go to the higher temperature ones, you have more photons. So there's a balance, and we have to do more work on this, obviously. There. The sort of things you're looking for is here, a difference by a factor of roughly 10 between these two cosmologies. Something like that is the signal that you want to be looking for here. The signal is particularly prominent above redshift 1, where you have 170 clusters versus 1, for example. I don't believe that we can currently distinguish between these two cosmologies.
No.
Oh, sorry, on the basis of clusters alone. I wouldn't go so absolutely far as to say I thought that omega equals 1 was completely ruled out, no.
But are you sure you learn more about cosmology than you do about systematics if you're not seeing other relationships?
Well, that would be an interesting question. I don't know. And these measurements are in some way complementary to other measurements you can make, which is everyone's favorite phrase for we're not as good, but we want to do what we're doing anyway. It's a different way of looking at things. Yeah, I said that, yeah?
It's a lot of effort, right?
Yeah, there's only two measurements.
Yeah, that's right.
This is a lot of effort.
I'm highlighting the cosmological aspect, but it's also to do with having a large catalog of galaxy clusters. It's about using these clusters for follow-ups with Sinai of Zeldovich to understand their detailed properties and so on here. But I think this effort is worth it nonetheless, anyway, in its own right. But it's not the only thing. I mean, I'm outlining here partly just the sort of size of catalog that will become available, which is sort of about an order of magnitude bigger than existing ones, with much better data on each of the clusters.
You want to double.
Sorry?
What was the issue? You want to distinguish open from land?
In principle, I think it's possible to measure lambda with high redshift sample. And I haven't actually written up numbers here because the universe isn't open, so it doesn't really matter. And I'm willing to say it might not be lambda, but I'm not willing to say that it's significantly open. So there you go. So I just want to finish up by saying a little bit about the challenges. Now, basically, what I've done is given you the numbers for 4 keV, but if you go down to 2 keV, which is the sort of number we have in mind, they jump by another order of magnitude. So the sort of number of clusters we expect to see is round about 10,000 that we would be interested in. Now, the problem is, in order to actually figure out which ones are the interesting ones, you have to have redshifts. And 10,000 objects is a lot to redshift when they're randomly scattered about the sky. And so you can't use multi-object techniques to do that. So one of the things we've been wondering about a lot is how to actually optimize the follow-up onto the high redshift subsample as best as we can to use what follow-up time we've got. Now, I think one very important idea, which has not really been focused on too much in the literature, is the apparent cluster temperatures. So far I've talked about the actual cluster temperatures, but what you see in these kinds of data is the apparent temperature, T divided by 1 plus Z. You can get that from the data for, typically, I would expect about 2,000 of the 10,000 clusters. So those are the 2,000 interesting ones. So bear in mind, for example, if I've decided that a 4 keV cluster redshift 1 is interesting, unfortunately, it looks as if it's only 2 keV in temperature. I've just told you that there are 9,000 clusters, which are 2 keV or so. So the hot high redshift interesting ones are potentially, as far as temperature is concerned, look just the same as the low nearby dull ones that we're not so interested in. So you have to worry about that a bit, and there's lots of things you can do, but I thought I'd highlight this particular one. This is a plot by Pedro Viana, who likes yellow. It's not come out too badly, actually. The colors are not too good all round, actually. What this plot's supposed to show you, first of all, this is a sample, I think these are the complete samples of clusters where temperatures can be measured in some Monte Carlos. This is a low density model, there's about 1,000 of them. This is a critical density one, there's about 500 of them. These ones are typically lower temperature than these ones. On the x-axis is the apparent temperature, so if you're interested in ones, redshift temperature 2 to 3 or something, it's all of these things here. There. The colors show you the actual redshifts. Now, they're very hard to see, but the pink ones up here, redshift 0 to 0.2. Then there's some green ones. I have to have a word with Pedro. There's some light blue ones, which are 0.2 to 0.4. Some dark blue ones, which are the next 0.2. Some green ones, some yellow ones. And finally, the red ones, which there are three, are above 1. So what you're supposed to, so for example, if I take the clusters of apparent temperature 2, all of these ones here, if I happen to take the red one, it's a redshift 1 or so, its actual temperature is 4, whereas these ones are cooler. The point I'm supposed to be trying to make is that we've scattered these points according to the known uncertainties in temperature and luminosity, and to some reasonable degree there is segregation of the population along these bands, with the furthest clusters of a given apparent temperature being the lowest ones. So the very most trivial thing you can do is actually just to make some sort of cut in observed luminosity. And what you will finish up throwing out in observed flux. What you'll do is you'll finish up throwing out all the nearby ones and keeping all the far away ones, which have the same apparent temperatures, and then do some redshift follow-up on them. There's other things you can do. Apparent size is useless, but if you have imaging, then you can do photometric redshifts and brightest cluster galaxies and lots of stuff like that. So on the whole, I don't think it would be enormously challenging to do this, and hopefully some people in our consortium will actually get around to doing it. Thanks. Any questions? I'm not aware of any new ones which are being done, and there is a whole stack of them. The SHARC survey is the only one that went to significantly high redshift. XMMs has follow-up programs on those particular items. There's lots and lots of low redshift ones, usually about 400 or 500, I think, in Reflex and BCG, is that what it's called? I'll forget what it, yeah. There.
Yeah, that's right.
The flux limit is higher for.
Yeah, the flux limit isn't really the same. That's sort of
very different.
Well, they like the Clinton survey goes to 10^-14, but it only covers like 1 square degree.
That's right.
Whereas they cover several hundred, well, 100 square degrees at a much brighter flux limit. They really cover very little sky.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff here. Yeah, so these are this will be the entire 10 years. So this is 800 square degrees. For these are all the clusters you can measure temperatures on, so you can see roughly what the flux limit is for that. The flux limit for seeing clusters at all will lie a factor of a few below that and generates 10 times as many clusters, roughly speaking. I wouldn't entirely agree with that statement, because the number density is not very important for ruling these out. What's crucially important is whether the temperature determination is correct or not. And even having 5 times as many objects, well, I mean, if the temperatures are still okay, then that's fine. But yeah, there's...
The claim is that these are high luminosity objects similar to MST.
Yeah. Yeah, something I'd like to understand, and if you want to comment, is about it, whether or not these can be AGN contaminated significantly. It seems to me is much more likely to be an issue than people seem to think, but I'm pretty ignorant on these things.
Being contaminated by the AGN?
Yeah, with the temperature estimates in particular.
I don't think that's a problem. But the fluxes. So all these guys from the Roadside Survey done optical follow-up, and some of these sources that basically look like point sources actually are galaxy clusters. So they, if a significant fraction of cluster luminosity is coming in, which is unlikely to, then their luminosity would be fine.
Another thing we found, which I don't understand and no one's been able to explain, is when we simulate the spectra using XSpec and then fit for the temperatures after putting in the background, temperature of high temperature clusters is always overestimated. That's about the 1 sigma level. There's a table in our paper which shows this, and no one has adequately explained this to us yet. And even at that level, I think that would make a big difference. You have to push the temperature down from 12 to 10 or something like that. Then that really changes the constraint in a big way. Yeah, it's quite curious. Anyway, you know, all talks like this always end saying we need better data. So we need better data.
Sounds like you need a better software, I guess.
And sense of the point, yeah. You volunteering to write it?
Brian.
Okay, I should end there.